when you're discussing chemistry, as you do, you often come up against the problem that people are at different levels and they've learnt certain things at one level and get really frightened and worried when they hear of something about the next level. And I've sort of encountered this in my discussion of hydrogen fluoride, you know, why that's an acid and what makes things an acid and chemical reactivity. So you've got this general lack of a sort of a roadmap to people's understanding. So when they get lost really quickly. And when people say, hey, come over here, let's learn a bit more, they get a bit suspicious. They like it from a standard source, the standard textbooks and stuff like that. So this is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. And in this episode, I'm just going to try and develop a sort of an overview of where we're at in terms of chemistry. Now, there's a couple of characters in chemistry which we want to talk about, and I'll just list them at this point in time. There's Aristotle with the ancient Greeks. There's sort of late Middle Ages, a chap called Becher. There's Priestley, who discovered oxygen. Lavoisier, Liebig, Arrhenius, Bronsted, Lowry, Lewis, and a few others, going even higher in-depth understanding of chemistry. So if you noted that I've picked up roughly 10 characters, 10 points in our timeline to discuss chemistry, and so Aristotle will be number one, and Lewis is number 8 in this timeline, where the fundamental observations, fundamental ideas slowly come to light. Now, the important thing here is that if you're trained at university, you're at level 8, 9, 10. In high school, you get up to the end of high school, you might get up into level 8, but the vast majority of people are sitting around 6 to 6.5. You can see what I'm talking about just by actually putting numbers associated with these people, these timelines. You can actually, with a number, sort of describe pretty quickly where someone's at. And so the rest of this episode, I'm just going to slowly walk you through the way that we had certain ideas, the tiny incremental ideas which help explain the world, but they've eventually built up to where we're at the moment. So your ideas 1 and 2 and stuff like that, people who are sitting at 6.5 will say, well, of course, I don't want to know about those ideas because they're not relevant. I'm in my 6.5 to 7 area of understanding chemistry. That's all that's important to me. But if you've got a broader view, seeing that people, if you're, say, sitting at 8 looking down, you can see, well, we really have to discuss this whole series. So let's start with Aristotle. Now, Aristotle is a person, but really ancient Greek philosophy has been up to Aristotle. And I've listed, I think, the 40 most influential philosophers in the ancient era to give you a similar timeline to work through it in your head. But Aristotle's important because we often associate him with the four elements. In fact, there's a bit of a surprise here. Four elements are earth, water, air, and fire. And this is a descriptive thing of basically what do I have in front of me, what is it largely made of, and a categorization area. So it's a bit like a treating the world as a supermarket. Intellectually, everything outside the supermarket is all over the place, but in the supermarket of your head, everything's in aisles. It's in the earth aisle, or the water aisle, the air aisle, or the fire aisle. And this is really good. This is very descriptive, but it can sort of describe a photograph, but it can't describe the scenes going up. So you can see a campfire, but it can't describe someone lighting a match, lighting the sequence of things which are going on, the interactions which are going on. So that's Aristotle's number one at number one area. Now, I have to say that Aristotle was a master at, he was a master fixer for explanations, I would say, in terms of that. He could see philosophically this four elements, as it's called, the four basic components of everything, had some problems. It worked very, very well in terms of the actual objects themselves had a want. And we actually have a sophisticated, that idea of wanting is still sophisticated. Electrons are feeling electrostatic force, and that's the major thing which is driving reactions, and people don't understand that fully deeply, and so they still use the same machinery that Aristotle did of saying things behave because they want to do things. So this is talking way up at 10 level of understanding. You can see looking back that this want area is still in the fabric of everything. It doesn't really disappear right to the very last point. But Aristotle, the master fixer, introduced his own fifth element, which is the more important things. He just simply reported on the previous elements, everybody, and actually linked it into a system of four causes, but he actually had a fifth element called ether. Now, this fifth element called ether was a sort of theoretical element which allowed things to propagate. And this ether was believed, thoroughly believed as a scientific belief up to basically Einstein, 1905. And still then, people still really held on to it. They believe that there was this fifth element from Aristotle. So it's pretty amazing to think this person, although people have chewed away at the idea of earth, fire, and all that type of stuff, explaining what we now understand as chemistry, he actually did produce a fifth element, and that fifth element survived really the modern scientific era. In fact, everyone still believed it. Now we go through into the late, so that's done number one, and that's descriptive. We've got someone here who's one, this is called Becher from the late Middle Ages. I don't really know too much about his biography, but I do know that he said, oh, look, we're going to have to move on from Aristotle. And so what he did was that he said, well, look, I'm going to actually work with the earth element, and I'm going to introduce the properties of the earth element as subcategories of that element. In doing so, he actually invented a component of the earth element called phlogiston. And if you like to think of it, phlogiston is sort of guessing what oxygen is, but getting it all wrong, all back to front. So his idea was that when you have a fire, the fire doesn't consume oxygen, it actually produces phlogiston. And and the air has a certain amount of phlogiston which can hold. So if you, so phlogiston is, say, like a molecule, it's like oxygen. And we'll have to really get into oxygen next. So eventually, there's only so much phlogiston which can go into air. So if you put a cup over a candle, that candle will extinguish because the phlogiston in that candle will be pushed out and actually fill up, and it won't be able to leave the air anymore. So this is very much almost a pre-chemical phlogiston, and it's quite a reasonable stab of what's going on. One doesn't think of anything. It actually doesn't have any chemical reaction there. It's sort of like a pressure, like you can only blow up a balloon so much and it stops. So there's no actual chemical change going on. It's just a change releasing a component. It's sort of decomposition. Something's released this phlogiston. The next level, so that's number two. Next level three is priestly. This Priestley is credited with the discovery of oxygen, and I just can't quite remember the chemical reaction he used to discover oxygen. I do remember the Swedish person who actually beat him by a year or so to it. And I can't remember his name, but I do remember that he used mercury oxide, heating up mercury oxide, and when you heat up mercury oxide, it releases oxygen. So it's, mercury oxide is rather an interesting but possibly toxic thing to deal with. So if you leave mercury out, you can actually... I do remember my chemistry teacher doing this. So I don't believe how... mercury oxide's a red sort of powder. I don't know how you actually make mercury oxide. You have to react it. It's a red powder. And so when you heat it up, it breaks apart and produces this oxygen. And so the idea here is that the air contained a dephlogen agent. That's what Priestley understood. He didn't call it oxygen. It's an agent. There's a component within air, and the fire actually takes this component without air. So Priestley still was describing things descriptively, but he was saying that there's this agent which is anti-phlogiston, which is obviously we'll recognise a bit later on as oxygen, as oxygen, and so he got half the way there, and but he is credited with discovering something obviously which he didn't name. That brings us up to the fourth person. So there's, you know, 1, 2, 3, which is Aristotle, Belcher, Priestley. They're descriptive people. They're sort of trying to discuss what's going on rather than write equations. The next person is Lavoisier. Now, he is in France. He's an aristocrat who's pretty smart, and he conducts a lot of experiments, early experiments, in an era before he goes commercial, and he came up with the idea, he actually named oxygen, and the news of his sort of principal idea is something according, and he's obviously, everyone's obviously pipped the post, that's other people, but he is credited with the law of conservation of mass, and that is that there's a certain amount of chemicals you use, and you can transform it, and you get a certain amount of chemicals at the end. And so he was saying, so he basically shifted everything from descriptive into the basic understanding of chemistry. And he had noted the following things, that if you burnt things like, I suppose, sulfur or carbon, you got carbon dioxide or sulfur oxide, and you mix those gases with water, those gases make acid. And this is really relevant because he noted that this component, this dephlogenating component of Priestley, had to have made acid. And of course, the ancient Greek word for something which is acidic is oxy, and to make or generate is gen, so acid generator, oxygen. So that's how he came up with the word oxygen. And he said, look, that's not so much a property or a component or multiple things. It's pretty much one thing, and it's this component of oxygen, of the atmosphere, oxygen. And if you put a candle, a cup over a candle, the candle goes out, it's the oxygen which is removed from the air, the dephlogestinating agent. But he's called oxygen because he says it's oxygen is acid generating. So here's our very first level of chemistry, the law of conservation of mass, and gives us a little idea of being able to sort of label and seal off the Flossgen theory and put it to bed, because he's replaced it with this other weird theory, and we've just forgotten what the word oxy means. So rather than calling it, you know, fill your lungs with some dephlogenating agent, fill your lungs with oxygen, which means acid makers. And it's sort of pretty interesting sort of concept to get in. And his basic understanding of your chemical equation, if you look at a chemical equation, the left and the right hand side, the mass of all those atoms are the same on either side, so that's conservation of mass. His first idea is an acid is to do with oxygen. Now, he's a person not quoted, but Davy, Sir Humphrey Davy, really interesting character, went over to France and all that type of stuff. I should go back on to Priestley. Priestley was a little bit wacko and supported the French Revolution and a whole lot of other ideas, and became so unpopular in Britain for supporting the War of Independence and things like that, that he went over to America. So he's the first sort of American early scientist. He's an early scientist, similar to Einstein, started in Europe and went over to America. I don't know if he did all that much in America. So there's your American home genius, which is Benjamin Franklin, and there's stories of him, Benjamin Franklin, coming across to France, and so they crisscross all the time. But Benjamin Franklin basically came up with the idea of the blind test. This is the site or the application of scientific investigation where you don't know the answer, and so you don't have the answer in your mind. So there's a story about that. I should discuss that a bit later on. So we've got up to four. So just to recap: Aristotle, Becher, Priestley, Lavoisier. And Lavoisier has named oxygen, and he's got into setting up the question of what is an acid, and acid's a very interesting thing. The next person here who got more acid rather than focusing on oxygen is a person, I don't know if I pronounced his name right, he's number five. He's only interesting because he's a midpoint between Lavoisier and the rest of modern chemistry. And he said, so acids are created, acids are things that attack metal and release hydrogen. So hydrogen's very important with an acid. So an acid has to have hydrogen, and it has to be able to eat a metal. And you know that in chemistry, that you put a little bit of magnesium into hydrochloric acid and little hydrogen bubbles off. So that's his view. He's starting to have a more chemical chemistry definition built up from Lavoisier, and it's a bit more quantitative again, and it starts to look at hydrogen. And the people who are at 6.57 say, oh, he's on the right track at the hydrogen story. And of course, there's a bigger story, of course, the 8, 9, 10. And so people are very comforted by this. They lead the story. There's nothing to worry about. Of course, the majority of people aren't interested in earlier wrong theories and are distressed about more advanced theories, which, you know, why haven't they been told? If it was a real theory, I would have been told all about them. Let's settle back. Now, you then have Arrhenius at number six. So this is at the descriptive end of what an acid and a base is. And this is what we really have a teaching. This is why we sort of focus on this area, because sixth is teaching or an observation, and seven is an equation. So six is Arrhenius,
And Arrhenius said, look, an acid, and this is where we define things at school, an acid is anything that when you add it to water increases the proton or H plus concentration. And he also said a base produces the OH concentration. So Arrhenius is a descriptive thing. He says that I can tell what an acid is by what's added. And I think, interestingly, he got a Nobel Prize, one of the early Nobel Prizes for being to set this up. Now, you have to remember that the electron was only discovered in 1899, so it's fair enough that chemistry didn't have too much of a strong bound basis. They still didn't have really the periodic table or understanding of electrons, so it's quite reasonable, Arrhenius. And so that's really the school level understanding of something. An acid increases the pH, decreases the pH, increases the number of H plus ions. So that's what we talk at school. The next level is a bit more specific. It's the Bronsted-Lowry theory, and this is the sort of chemical equation theory that you write up. And so an acid is it's all about proton giving and proton receiving, and so it's saying that next level up, writing equations, I have a chemical, it's got a proton, it's not interested in keeping around it, it would prefer to dispense that proton into a liquid and just keep its electron. So that's HCl. Arrhenius, who noted that metals form bases and non-metals form acid, the Lowry theory, the Bronsted-Lowry theory, started to add a little bit to it, being able to write the equations. And this is the general equations you see on the board, that something is an acid if it actually produces H+, it donates H+, and you start to get neutralization reactions. And that's all proton doning. So let's recap so far. You have anti-oxygen, real oxygen, and we've moved across onto that. And then we've got an acid isn't oxygen, it's actually hydrogen, and you've got a few steps in here. You see hydrogen being lifted off. You've got the hydrogen ion put inside things, which is theory number 6, the Arrhenius theory. Then you've got the actual chemistry theory, and this is where people mostly leave at school, year 10. Leave at school saying that's the real theory. What more could you want? So that's why I say most schools between 6.5, at least people at 6.5, they can definitely tell you the 6 aspect of it, and they may scratch their head a little bit to struggle through the 7 bit, but because there's that gradient there, they really don't think there's anything more. But there, of course, there is a little bit more. You've got the problem of acid rain. This is the power stations that are putting out carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, sulfur trioxide, and the further elements. And these gases, when you mix them with water, they make an acid out of it. Yeah. How can they donate a proton if they don't have a proton to donate at the start? So what is going on here? And you've got a few other things. This is ammonia. It's got 3 protons with it. Why would it not donate one of those protons? Why is it actually saying, look, I'll take on another one and form NH4 plus
It's got a proton on top of it. And so that's a base without having the hydroxide. So the idea is that an acid has H plus and a base has OH minus. And you've got these other classes of compounds which don't fit the mould. And in actual fact, you have the Lewis theory, which is the one that I'm going to end at the moment. There's other theories beyond this. And basically, I can say the other theories are interesting. There's a lot of interest in it. But essentially, you're almost better off with just thinking about through the quantum mechanics or the basics of it. But 8 is the Lewis theory. The Lewis theory says, don't look at the protons, look at whether it wants electrons. So if it really wants electrons, it will take the electrons from whatever is required, and if it does that, it will become negatively charged and create H+. And that's what actually happens in carbon dioxide. So if carbon dioxide, you can imagine an oxygen molecule. That's two oxygens, and a carbon sits in between. So the oxygen is getting the its electrons. It wants to squirrel away electrons inside it. So it gets these electrons, and sort of half does it, and actually stores the electron midway between the oxygen nucleus and the carbon nucleus and the next oxygen nucleus. Because the electrons are stored in between, it creates electrostatic attraction between them all. And this is called a binding configuration of electrons. But it still wants some more. So what happens is that CO2, when it goes into water, will start to eat the electron from the water. That's H2O. And it will pull it off the water. And as the electron leaves the outer reaches of the water, it then goes into the CO2 molecules, forming CO or HCO3 hydrogen carbonate, a minus ion, and because you've minus ion, because it's got an extra electron and the proton has gone off, and so it's actually sucked in the electron and it's released a proton into the water. Now you could say that when this occurs, the you've got a sort of the electron is now deep away, is inaccessible, and there's a whole lot of water which is interested in this situation, so it sticks and forms a ball around your minus HCO3, and it forms a ball, just a theoretical ball of oxygen. It's not of water, it's not coordinated, so you don't put a dot H2O with a number of coordinate around the outside, but sufficient to actually diffuse that negative charge. And depending on how that does it, it becomes more and more acidic. So this is that the actual reaction. If you can see two reactions written, they produce H+. Well, one will be more acidic than the other. The one will actually produce more available H+. H pluses, which are looking around for things to do. And we come over to SO2 or SO. 4, if you want to be the most extreme. These are Lewis acids, you can describe it as other classical acids. These actually take in the electron, so it's defined as your Rønsted-Lowry acid as well, which is a proton donor, but it's really in the Lewis theory, which is your next theory up, it's the fact that it's actually withdrawn electrons and actually hidden the electrons. So if it withdraws an electron, it doesn't hide the electron, the hydrogen will still stick around and not move or dissociate. That is, dissociate, no longer hang around with it. So the Lewis diagrams theory of Lewis acids talks about more the electron transfer, the dative way of saying it. Now, if we look at another situation, if something's got almost too many electrons, it will give those electrons away and attach itself to something which is a positive ion. A positive ion wants electrons, which is a Lewis acid, something which wants electrons. So you can have ammonia, and it's got spare electrons on its top, so to speak, in the other orbital, and it will give those electrons away. Or you can see it the other way, the earlier theory, it will accept H plus ion, and you can write it both ways, but the easiest way is to understand it through this Lewis diagram. Now, going all the way in that sort of the next level, there's some other fairly rare theories, but really the next theory to understand what's going on is to have a quantum mechanical insight as to what's going on. When I say quantum mechanical, it's just not believing electrons are tiny classical semi-classical things orbiting. They've actually got shapes and can actually deform and hide and move away from each other, producing the complex chemistry that you understand. So this is, I suppose, a problem for all educators, in that you have your class, when they come to you, are pretty much out in the 1 to 2 area. You have to actually bring them up, hopefully not through all these side blind alleys where we got half the right idea but turned down the wrong direction. You can bring them up to a 6 and a 7, if you really want to play or understand or think deeply about these things or get a greater interest, you've got to get up to the 8, and in the HC and higher levels you have to start talking about Lewis acids. So the Lowry Bronsted acid are also members of the Lewis acid. The Lewis acids is a more general theory to discuss it. I suppose the concluding thing is that an acid plus a base goes to a salt plus water, but really there's a more general equation that an acid and a base goes to an acid and a base, because the actual salt is not a dissolved salt. It's not an actual physical salt. It can be a salt. It can be a precipitation salt. But say if it's still dissolved, that is really also an acid plus a base. It's a background reaction. So you have the idea of a conjugate acid and a conjugate base. So if it's given up a hydrogen, it can now... So one reaction, it acts as an acid giving up a hydrogen. You can reverse that reaction, and that species which has given up an ion can go the opposite way and actually take an ion with a conjugate base. So an acid and conjugate base are things to do. So I just really hope this clarifies a few things for you. What I've added is the 1 to 8 scale, so you can actually order these things. A bit of a story about Aristotle, we've actually gradually increased the scientific explanation aspect of it. A bit of the idea of how people made a bet that it was antiphlogiston, it was oxygen. Well, oxygen was the main candidate. Then people, that was hydrogen, got on hydrogen, then chemistry grew up looking at hydrogen, and that's where we tend to teach our kids. And then a slightly more sophisticated explanation, which covers a greater number of cases, you have the Lewis, and you do have the problem that if people are taught the 7 up to the 7 level, speaking the 8th level, that they really need some sort of scaffold to understand why they should even be listening, and so they can, I suppose, tend to react against it. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope this has been instructional, very useful for you. But in the meantime, keep on doing science.